Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, Internet world. Welcome to The Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble, and it's official. Right here in Florissant, where I live, we've had our first white stuff, our first snow. About an inch out on the ground, cars covered in snow, traffic moving slowly, and of course I have to work today, so it's going to be fun. I know a lot of people love the snow because they can get out of school, and when I was a kid, that was something I looked forward to the next day, saying, oh, no school today. Well, but when you're an adult many years later, there's not that joy and excitement when the snow comes in the ground, because you know, and I know, it is a mess trying to drive in it. So this is life in the adult world. I have a suggestion. Let's not all grow up. Let's just stay kids, right? Well, today on The Cross in the Desert, we have many areas to cover. We're going to talk about the continuing cancer of anti-Semitism in universities, schools, and also the UK. Ever since the resettlement resolution was passed against the Jewish people, my good friends from Israel, I really felt the need to talk more about this cancer, if you will, that's in the media. The United Nations, the media, it seems like that the world is aligned against Israel. And we discussed some of the reasons on our last broadcast, the so-called Palestinian problem, and we've talked about that subject. But we're going to talk some more today and give examples about just how deeply rooted this cancer of anti-Semitism is in universities, schools, and the UK. What I want to do this morning is I want to update you on Iranian political prisoner Aras Shadegi. Now, Monday, it was just shortly after the broadcast on Monday, I'm not sure if it was Monday evening, Tuesday morning, Aras ended his hunger strike because his wife, Golrakh, was released from Evin prison. But there are still real problems. The Iranian authorities need to transfer Aras to a facility that specializes in the kind of medical care he needs after this hunger strike. Now, you know, he went on this hunger strike back in October to protest the imprisonment of his wife, who actually had an unpublished story in her room when they went to search Arash's room and confiscate his computer. It was a story about stoning in Iran, and she, of course, was speaking out against the stoning practice. Well, the story had never been published, but because she had written it, they arrested Goldrock. Well, she was released, I think it was Tuesday morning, and Arash ended his hunger strike after 72 days, but the prison authorities have refused to transfer him. The delay in transferring him to a hospital to treat him is really cruel. It's inhuman and degrading. His situation is critical since the hunger strike, and he must receive specialized, urgent, and potentially life-saving treatment without any further delay. By failing to transfer Arash, they're really toying with his life, and they're flaunting their obligations under international law to provide him with access to adequate medical care. But since when did Iran ever care about any kind of international law? And it's a cruel and inhumane thing they're doing to Arash. Here's the problem. Arash is suffering from multiple health problems: inflamed and severely infected lungs, severe drops in blood pressure, irregular heartbeat, shortness of breath, nausea, and vomiting blood. Since the hunger strike, he has lost more than 20% of his weight. Doctors have expressed concern about long-term damage to his kidneys, and they have said and estimated that about 70% of his right kidney and 20% of his left kidney are not functioning. So this is critical. He needs to get to this hospital. And so my good friends Kaveh and Miriam have been relentlessly tweeting about Arash's condition and the absolute necessity for him to be transferred, because it's become utterly deplorable. But this is the way prisoners are treated in Iran. Kaveh has said to me many times, silent execution, white torture of prisoners continues in these Iranian prisons. And even though his wife is free, and I had a picture of her, a beautiful picture of her, she's very beautiful, up on my Facebook, and she looks like she's in relatively good condition, this must be torture on Goldrock to know that her husband has ended his hunger strike, and that's good, but he's not getting the adequate care. So here's what we need to do. We need to, as many as we can, share his story. If you're listening to this broadcast, come to my Facebook page. The story is there. Just scroll down. Please share Arash's story. Please get on Twitter. And with the hashtag #SaveArash, please tweet and get as much international attention as you can. I firmly believe that the entire world focusing in on Arash's hunger strike with dedicated human rights activists has made the difference in everything. So let's not stop. We have a battle. We have to fight and pray and speak out for Arash to immediately get this kind of treatment. Or here's the bad news. He could easily die very, very soon. This hunger strike, of course, took an incredible toll on his physical condition, as it would. So please do that. Please join me in speaking out. Please share his story. Please get on Twitter with the hashtag #SaveArash. Let's get as much attention as we can so that Iran will respond and take this man to the right kind of hospital to get the kind of treatment that he needs. Well, since we're talking about political prisoners and we're talking about the treatment of prisoners, I wanted to spend just a little bit of time to focus in on what happens in the women's ward at Evin Prison. This is a report which was brilliantly written by the Borger Dirty Civil Rights Group, and they do an amazing job keeping records of all of the executions that have happened in Iran, and they've detailed them since the 1979 revolution. It is amazing the job this group does. They keep everyone informed of what's happening, especially to political prisoners. I know I used a lot of information from them in the publication and the writing of my book about Rouhani, But this morning I want to focus in on the women's ward at Evan Prison. There are 32 women prisoners in this report, and we're going to focus in on two. And they are served a daily ration, which really has been provided for only 25 persons. And there is a prison store inside there that sells goods, but most of them are more expensive than the market value. Most of the prisoners have been deprived of furlough and conditional releases. They have a right to call their relatives maybe once per week, up to 10 minutes. And the new arrivals have to be a patient for many, many weeks to call home with their families. The women prisoners in Evan Prison suffer with insufficient medical services, and they're held without electricity or running water for over 2 hours, according to a detailed report. A little bit about, though, two specific prisoners that are currently in the women's ward at Evan Prison and give a little background on how they've been treated. We're going to talk about Atna Fatemi Dayami, and she's 29 years old, and she has a 7-year prison sentence. She was arrested on October 21st of 2014. She was taken here to Evan Prison, where she was detained in solitary confinement for 86 days. She was then transferred to the women's ward of Evan Prison and detained there until she was temporarily released on February of this year. She had to pay a bail equivalent to about $180,000 in U.S. money. Now, Amnesty did a report on the first 28 days of her detention. And here in Evan Prison, Atna was held in a cell that was infested with insects and no toilet facility. During that time, Atna was interrogated, blindfolded for about a month and a half. She had no access to a lawyer. And, of course, her mental and physical health was severely deteriorated during this time. And, again, no medical care. Now, this is what happens regularly in the women's ward. I want to also now turn to a Christian prisoner. Her name is Miriam Nassim Nagash Zagaran. She's 38 years old. She's single. She has a 4-year sentence in prison. She also, about 6 months ago, went on a hunger strike like Arash. They did give her medical attention, and she was released temporarily, but she's back in prison once again. Now, her crime is a propaganda against the Iran, against the regime. Now, she has had many health problems. And this list goes on and on. She suffers from atrial septal defect, which is a heart problem, diabetes. She suffers with severe pain in her ears and chronic dizziness. She has many physical health problems, but once again, they are not treated. And the most treatment that Miriam got was when she went on the hunger strike and nearly died like Arash. But she is back in Evan Prison once again without real treatment for these medical problems. So I wanted to give you just an idea of the things that go on in Evan Prison besides what we hear about the interrogation and the charges of rape that go on there to political prisoners. And then, of course, the silent execution. The list could go on and on how these beautiful women, and I say beautiful because they are inside and out, these very brave, beautiful, courageous women, how they're treated in the women's ward in Evan Prison. Our task is to do everything we can to make sure their stories are out there on Facebook and social media. I firmly believe in prayer, and I pray for them. I pray for my Iranian friends every day, and I do see the results of my praying. So please join me in speaking out and praying for Arash today, for Atna, for Miriam, and all prisoners in Evan Prison, especially in the women's ward. They need our prayers. They need our constant human rights activities, our speaking out. You may think, really, does this make a difference? And I will tell you, yes, it does. Not every case is turned around. Person is freed. But there is significant progress when you and I take the time to speak out and to pray. I want to spend a few minutes here trying to bring you, my audience, right into the heart of Iran, to understand a little bit about what women go through in the Islamic Republic of Iran. About 3.5 years ago, I published a novel called The Rose of Nowruz, Dreams of Hope and Freedom. And in this novel, I had a lead character named Behera, who was a top-notch concert violinist. And in this novel, Behera watches the Ghastir Shah, that is the morality police, beating up a woman right outside of her apartment, her flat, simply because she had an improper hijab. When she saw this, it had such an impact on her that she knew she could no longer be silent, that she had to do something for her friends, that she was suffering. She watched them suffer. One of the friends in the novel, a good friend of Behera, is Zainab. Now, Zainab is a lead character in a play with Behera called The Rose of Nowruz. It's a very interesting play. It is a play that talks about freedom but uses symbolism, because this is a play that Iranians can come to, and they have to be careful that the government doesn't discover what this play really is speaking about, or they would all be arrested. Now, in this play, Zainab plays a lead character. I want to read to you from my book this morning, because I want to take you into the streets of Tehran with Zainab and to see how she is treated by the morality police. I wrote this book after talking to several of my Iranian friends so I could really get enough detail and understanding of how this happens. And so what I want to read to you for the next few minutes from my book, The Rose of Nowruz, this is Zainab's experience in the streets of Tehran with the morality police. It was 7:15 a.m. Zainab was in a hurry. She was running very late. Class began at 8 a.m., and her morning had been a disaster. She had overslept and had to skip breakfast. Hurrying out of the bathroom, Zainab threw on an old pair of jeans and quickly pulled a black short-sleeved blouse over her head. She didn't have time to put on a hijab, so she quickly tied a black saffron scarf around her head and grabbed a pair of sunglasses. Running out of the front door, Zainab lifted the sunglasses up over her forehead and grabbed her book bag. Englehab Street was already filled with taxicabs, cars, motorcycles, and buses. The annoying sound of horns honking greeted Zainab's ears as she ran down the sidewalk past a street vendor selling various colored scarves. The sidewalks were also crowded with many university students hurrying off to class just like Zainab. Zainab stopped running and leaned over, touching her knees, already out of breath. The awful smell of air pollution burned underneath her nose. Tehran was at the top of the list as one of the worst cities in the world, with the ongoing problem of air pollution making it very unhealthy for its citizens. Zainab took a quick, deep breath. She gazed down at her watch. It was already 7:30 a.m. A stalled taxicab was causing a traffic jam. People were standing outside of their vehicles, yelling and shaking their fist in the air. It seemed that no one was in a good mood this morning in Tehran. Unable to cross the street, Zainab became frustrated and tried to cross from another way, but it was too late. The bus had arrived at the stop across the street, and there was no way Zainab was going to make it on time. Zainab bent down over her knees, gasping for breath as the bus pulled away. People yelling, honking horns, annoying air pollution. Zainab was about to have an emotional meltdown. She composed herself and looked up the street. There was a pastry shop less than a block away. She knew she was going to be late for class. Tehran University was more than 2 miles away, and it was a very long walk yet to Revolution Square. Zainab was frustrated and starving. A cup of hot tea and a fresh pastry would be the perfect breakfast right now. Wiping the sweat from off of her brow, Zainab took another deep breath and began to slowly walk in the direction of the pastry shop. "Excuse me, ma'am." Zainab felt a hand touch her shoulder. She quickly spun around. A tall, middle-aged woman, dressed in a black chador that covered her whole body like a tent, stood face to face with Zainab, carrying a radio in one hand and a clipboard in the other. Two uniformed officers were standing behind the woman, dressed in green and white jumper clothing and wearing stern expressions on their faces. It was the Gostier shot. Zainab's whole body tightened up with stress and anger. Drops of sweat streamed down her face. This was the last thing that she needed this morning, was a visit from the morality police. "What is your name, ma'am?" Zainab began to pant nervously out of breath. "Ma'am, I missed the bus. I'm late for class." The female officer gave Zainab a frustrated look. "You can make this easier by cooperating with me and answering our questions. What is your name?" Zainab took an angry deep breath and nervously bit her lip, placing her hands on her hips. "Zainab," she bluntly answered. The female officer began writing on her clipboard. "Zainab," the officer began, looking intently into Zainab's eyes. "Can I ask you a question, Zainab?" Zainab remained silent, too angry to respond. The female officer stood perfectly still for a few moments with her eyes riveted on Zainab. "Zainab, do you think you are dressed appropriately as a Muslim woman?" Zainab's heart began to beat faster in her chest. Feelings of anger and humiliation filled her mind. The female officer waited patiently for her to respond. Zainab wanted to bolt and run. She felt trapped and cornered. I was in a rush. I overslept," Zainab nervously explained. The female officer gazed up at the loose-fitting scarf tied around Zainab's head, touched her blonde strands of hair protruding out from beneath the scarf and drooping down over her forehead. Then she removed Zainab's sunglasses. "This is unacceptable for a Muslim woman," the officer complained with a disgusted tone in her voice. "This is an improper hijab, Zainab. Your hair is showing too much, and you have sunglasses sitting on top of your so-called makeshift hijab." Zainab breathed a frustrating sigh. The female officer then gazed down at her bare arms. She looked her head and shook her head in disgust. "You're showing too much skin." The officer began writing down notes on her clipboard. The two male officers gathered closer to Zainab and stood posed with their hands behind their backs. Sweat began pouring down Zainab's forehead. She felt desperate, wanting to escape. The female officer finished writing her notes and stared nervously once again at Zainab, handing her an official sheet of paper. "I want you to read this carefully and sign it. It is a declaratory promise that you intend to conform to the rules of the Islamic dress code and will immediately begin dressing in the proper attire." Zainab took the piece of paper from the officer's hand and nervously signed it. The officer became offended at Zainab's cavalier attitude. "Zainab, you must take this seriously. If I find you in violation next time, you will be arrested and fined." The anger and rage was burning inside of Zainab's soul. "Do you understand?" the female officer sternly asked. "Yes, ma'am," Zainab snapped back, biting her lower lip. "Ruz kosh." "That's Farsi for have a nice day," the female officer said. Then she quickly departed with the Gostier Shot officers. Feelings of anger and humiliation tore at Zainab's soul. Tears of hurt and anguish rolled down her cheeks. She quickly wiped them off in anger and looked down at her watch. It was 8:15 a.m. She was very late for class now. Picking up her book bag, Zainab began walking rapidly down the street. She was hungry, tired, and extremely frustrated, and didn't care if she ever made it to class again. This is from my book, The Rose of Nauruz, Dreams of Hope and Freedom. This gives you an up-close and personal look of what it's like to be confronted by the Gostier Shad. In Zainab's case, she wasn't beaten. She wasn't arrested or fined. But I wrote this because I want you to know a little bit about what women suffer through on this issue in the streets of Tehran. You can get my book, The Rose of Nauruz, up on Amazon.com. Just type in my name, Randy L. Noble, N-O-B-L-E. I want to turn our attention now to what's happening with Israel. With the United Nations and the betrayal of the Obama administration, the outgoing president, yes, we have only 15 days until Trump arrives. Thank you, God. But I want you to hear what Benjamin Netanyahu said in a speech a couple of months ago before this incident took place about the way the media, the way they are being portrayed, trying to survive in their little country of Israel. This is Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
I'm sure many of you have heard the claim that Jewish communities in Judea Samaria, the West Bank, are an obstacle to peace. I've always been perplexed by this notion, because no one would seriously claim that the nearly 2 million Arabs living inside Israel, that they're an obstacle to peace. That's because they aren't. On the contrary, Israel's diversity shows its openness and readiness for peace. Yet the Palestinian leadership actually demands a Palestinian state with one precondition: no Jews. There's a phrase for that. It's called ethnic cleansing. And this demand is outrageous. It's even more outrageous that the world doesn't find this outrageous. Some otherwise enlightened countries even promote this outrage. Ask yourself this: would you accept ethnic cleansing in your state, a territory without Jews, without Hispanics, without blacks? Since when is bigotry a foundation for peace? At this moment, Jewish school children in Judea Samaria are playing in sandboxes with their friends. Does their presence make peace impossible? I don't think so. I think what makes peace impossible is intolerance of others. Societies that respect all people are the ones that pursue peace. Societies that demand ethnic cleansing don't pursue peace. I envision a Middle East where young Arabs and young Jews learn together, work together, live together, side by side, in peace. Our region needs more tolerance, not less. So the next time you hear someone say Jews can't live somewhere, let alone in their ancestral homeland, take a moment to think of the implications. Ethnic cleansing for peace is absurd. It's about time somebody said it. I just did.
That is Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu with some excellent points in that very short speech, because on the charter of Hamas is the destruction of the Jewish people. There is no peace possible with Palestinians, with the terrorist groups that continue to want to wipe out Israel off the face of the mat. And as I was preparing for this show this week, I came across several examples of just how the media is very, very tainted toward bigotry and anti-Semitism. And simply because there are a few outlets that will report the truth doesn't change the fact that most of the media is biased towards the Jewish people. And there are several examples of anti-Semitism. I could add so many more, but I want to focus in on this morning one example of the continuing cancer of anti-Semitism. And this is a report about anti-Semitism in UCLA, in the university. Let's listen.
U.S. education funding is being used to fuel anti-Semitism at UCLA. That report comes from a study by the AMCHA Initiative. The three-year study uncovered widespread anti-Semitism in UCLA's Center for Near East Studies. It concludes that events there focused heavily on Israel and the Israeli-Arab conflict, and 93% of those events were anti-Israel. 75% of those activities included anti-Semitic conversation. At that time, the CNES received $1.5 million from the Department of Education. The co-founder of AMCHA said federal funds are being used by a top-tier public university to promote one-sided anti-Semitic programming that masquerades as scholarship. That is absolutely appalling.
And joining us now is Asher Intrader. He's the director of Revive Israel Ministries and the pastor of two congregations, one in Jerusalem and one in Tel Aviv. He's also the author of numerous books about Israel and its role in history. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Ev.
First off, why is anti-Semitism so rampant throughout history?
Well, the issue of anti-Semitism, it has to do with a similar spirit to hating Jesus, because after all, Jesus is Jewish, and therefore the very fact of our existence is a proof of the Bible. So the spiritual forces that are against the Bible and against God and even against Jesus want to destroy that. There's a hatred against God's covenant. There are promises in the Bible that for Jesus to return and set up his kingdom upon the earth, there must be Jewish people in Israel. So there, everything that would be against the return of Jesus is also against the return of the Jewish people to the land and faith in Jesus among the Jewish people there.
Is that why Israel is under attack right now on so many different fronts?
Well, I do believe there is a spiritual root to all those attacks. If you look today in Israel, on the south and west side, you have Hamas. In the north, you have Hezbollah in Lebanon. You have Al-Qaeda forces now coming through Syria to the Israeli border, and the ISIS forces coming out of Iraq toward Jordan, toward Israel. So you see the focus of international Islamic extremism and jihad focused on this nation.
Why is it so important for Christians to stand with Israel and the Jewish people?
Well, I think that goes to a very deep question about what does it mean to be a Christian? Mm. To be a Christian, you are believing in Jesus. His Hebrew name is Yeshua. He's the son of David. He is not only the head of the church, he is also the king of Israel. And we believe by the very fact when someone becomes a believer in Jesus, he becomes spiritually part of the greater household of Israel, of the spiritual sons of Abraham, loyalty to David. I don't think that you can actually really be a believer in Jesus without feeling spiritually attached to this nation, because the Messiah is the king. He is connected with Israel. And there's a new union and cooperation between the nation of Israel and evangelical Christians around the world that I think is very biblical and very covenantal.
Your insight is both an inspiration and reminder for us of who is in control. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Very interesting report that gets to the spiritual cause of all of this. And if you're a student of Scripture like me, you love to read the prophetic word. And the mention of the Jews returning to their homeland, there are several references in Jeremiah and Ezekiel that talk about a future when they will return, and that's been happening now for many, many years. But also in the book of Zechariah, speaking about the anti-Semitism and the things that are happening in Jerusalem, God says in Zechariah chapter 12, verse 2, "Behold, I am about to make Jerusalem a cup of staggering to all the surrounding peoples. The siege of Jerusalem will also be against Judah." And God says, "On that day, I will make Jerusalem a heavy stone for all the peoples. All who lift it will surely hurt themselves, and all the nations of the earth will gather against it." It's very interesting how God has said several times, and this is one of many times, of what is going to happen in the future to his people. And notice that the focus of the world is right there on Jerusalem. And you see that today. It's very, very evident of what is going on is really fulfilling what God has said more than 1,000 years ago. Well, we see what's happening in Israel, and we hear what's happening over there as far as anti-Semitic forces, and we've heard a little bit about what goes on at UCLA. Let's also investigate anti-Semitism in the UK. I want you to hear this special report now.
The eve of Sukkot, and this Jewish community in North London is preparing for 7 days and seven nights of festivities. But the streets are shared with a noticeable police presence, and a report released today might help explain why. Hate crimes against Jews have increased by nearly a third since 2010, according to the Home Affairs Select Committee report, and the volume and viciousness of online abuse is unprecedented. It's all news that comes as no surprise to the community.
We will get calls from visibly Jewish people, whether it's in London, North Manchester, Gateshead, Leeds, other places, who tell us that on a regular basis when they walk to and from synagogue, they get abused, shouted at them by people on street corners, by people from passing cars. They may get stones or coins thrown at them. And for too many people, this is something they feel they have to put up with because it's just part of being Jewish.
The report shows an 11% rise in anti-Semitic incidents in the first half of this year compared to 2015. It also shows the number of people in Britain with anti-Semitic attitudes rose by 50% in just 12 months. And as many as 1 in 20 adults in the UK could now be characterised as clearly anti-Semitic. Daniel and Theo are barely in their teens, children who say they've had vicious hate shouted at them by grown men.
We were getting onto a bus and a car was driving by, and seeing as we were wearing our suits and our kippah on our heads, The car slowed down and shouted, "You Jewish."
I was just thinking, why do they feel that way just because we're Jewish? I just felt it was unfair, and I just hadn't experienced anything like this before.
As bleak a picture as this report paints of anti-Semitism across the whole of the UK, some of the most critical lines are reserved for the Labour Party, saying there is, quote, safe space for people with vile attitudes towards the Jewish people. It also goes on to say that on this issue, Jeremy Corbyn has shown, quote, a lack of consistent leadership.
It's of a different order to criminal hate speech, but the report cites cases like Naz Shah, who was suspended by the Labour Party for anti-Semitic Facebook posts before being elected to Parliament, and Ken Livingstone, who defended her before making further inflammatory comments. He was suspended too, but Ms. Shah was allowed back into the party less than 3 months later.
Every political party has a problem and can and needs to do much better on tackling anti-Semitism. But let's not beat around the bush. The Labour Party has a particular problem with anti-Semitic incidents at the moment over the last year, and that's under Jeremy Corbyn's watch, I'm afraid.
Jeremy Corbyn today has criticised the report for unfairly focusing on Labour. He also said that under his leadership, Labour has taken greater action against anti-Semitism than any other party.
I'm glad to hear that there is something being done about, but it's still very rampant in the UK, as you see a lot of jihadist kind of patrols going on there. Muslims have their hijab patrols, I should say, but it's really the same thing, have their patrols, and they will stop women who are walking around without proper hijab. These are Muslims in the UK. But the anti-Semitic flavor comes deeply from the Islamic holy book, the Quran. I want to spend just a couple of minutes to really give you an idea of Islam's ancient hatred for the Jews. And one particular surah, chapter 5, verse 64, says of the Jewish people, "Amongst them we, that is Allah, have placed enmity and hatred till the day of judgment. Every time they kindle the fire of war, Allah doth extinguish it. But they ever strive to do mischief on earth, and Allah loveth not those who do mischief." It's very clear that there will be enmity and hatred against the Jews until the end of the age. And it's really interesting for those who claim that the Quran's scorn for the Jews is limited only to specific instances in Muhammad's career. So they want to say, well, there was some kind of conflict, but that was only when Muhammad was alive. It's wrong. The Quran portrays Jews as those who start wars and do general mischief in the earth. But it also claims that Allah was so disgusted by the Jews that he cursed them and literally transformed many of them into apes and swine, assigning them the lowest rank among humankind. Surah chapter 7, verse 166. "When in their insolence they transgressed all prohibitions, we said to them, Be ye apes, despised and rejected." Those who incurred the curse of Allah in his wrath, those of whom he transformed into apes and swines, those who worshiped evil, these are worse in rank and far more astray from the even path. These are referring to the Jewish people. It's very, very clear that if you read the Quran, that comes up. And in fact, there is a quote in the Hadith about the final slaughter of the Jews. And I want you to hear this. Muhammad said the last hour would not come unless the Muslims will fight against the Jews, and the Muslims would kill them until the Jews would hide themselves behind a stone or a tree, and a stone or a tree would say, "Muslim or the servant of Allah, there is a Jew behind me, come and kill him." Now, this is in the Hadith, and I will get you the exact quote on this. I should have that here for you, and let me see if I can find it really, really fast. It is Muslim Book 041, number 6985. Sahih Muslim Book 041, number 6985, so you can check it for yourself. I know there are some Muslims that want to discredit the Hadith, but let me tell you what, the majority of Muslims that are serious about their faith accept the Hadith, and they see it nearly equal to the teachings of the Quran. So I have no problem bringing this information out. This is very, very clear that it's taught in the Quran, it was taught by Muhammad, and there is obviously anti-Semitism in the Quran against the Jewish people. So that we've been looking at this morning in universities in the UK, and now even here in the United States, there are instances of anti-Semitism. Here's one example from a school in Atlanta. Let's listen.
Swastikas and Hitler's name all over a playground. Now Atlanta public school officials are investigating who left these hateful messages at an elementary school.
It happened on the eve of the Jewish holiday Rosh Hashanah. Only Fox 5's Jacqueline Schultz spoke to parents who say they're worried the timing is no coincidence.
Well, the Jewish holiday Rosh Hashanah is a joyful and a happy celebration. So you can imagine how disturbed and sad some parents were when they came to this playground and saw some very hateful messages against the Jewish faith.
And somebody felt the need to write some hateful speech.
Swastikas, Hitler's name. Someone scrawled hateful messages all over the playground at Mary Lynn Elementary.
I was just shocked. And in this, you know, pretty diverse community.
Karen Callen and her kids are some of plenty of people who saw the messages Sunday afternoon. She and other Jewish families wonder if the timing for the stunt is no coincidence.
On the eve of Rosh Hashanah, which is a really joyous time for Jews to celebrate the new year. But, you know, maybe just a reality check of the world that we live in.
The message, a sad sight for families on the eve of the Jewish holiday. Atlanta Public Schools tells Fox 5 the vandalism is being investigated by APS police, and it's reviewing surveillance to find the culprits. The principal sent this letter home to parents saying the school is no place for hate.
I mean, did you start?
Karen Callen says she used the ordeal to teach her kids why some people may write messages like this.
There are good people and there are bad people, and there are people who treat all people with kindness and respect, and then there are other people who, for whatever reason, you know, have hate in their hearts.
In Northeast Atlanta, Jacqueline Schultz, Fox 5 News.
Very, very sad to hear things like that happening here on our public school playgrounds. Well, this morning I've taken a look at anti-Semitism in the universities, in the countries of the world, in the UK, anti-Semitism in the Quran. Well, now, wait a minute. What about anti-Semitism in the Bible? Being a Christian, this is very important. This is a question that deserves a response. Because there would be those that say, well, Randy, your own Bible is filled with hate speech against the Jewish people. I mean, you as a Christian, isn't there remarks that Jesus made against the Jewish people? And what about the church fathers? Didn't they claim, well, the Jews murdered Jesus, so aren't they being anti-Semitic? Is your own New Testament anti-Semitic? Well, this is a very good question. And I think since we're on the topic of anti-Semitism, it's important to answer that. The first thing I want to do is play you a short clip from Jews for Jesus, and this is a lady that is a Jewish person answering this very important question about the claim that the New Testament is anti-Semitic. Let's listen.
The New Testament isn't anti-Semitic. It's easy to find in the Jewish scriptures a lot of passages that you could take as anti-Semitic. For instance, in Exodus 33, God calls the Jewish people a stiff-necked people, and there are many other places in the Jewish scriptures that my people are called faithless. And why is it that we often look at the New Testament and look at passages like that and call it anti-Semitic, when we have the same kind of passages in the Jewish scriptures and we don't want to call that anti-Semitic? In addition, the New Testament was written by mostly Jewish people. In fact, Paul, who was Jewish and originally a persecutor of the church, wrote almost half of the 27 New Testament books. The audience that was written to were Jewish people. And, you know, Jesus, if you look carefully at his statements, he did not attack the Jewishness of people. He himself was Jewish. But rather, he attacked the people's faithlessness toward God. And also, the word Jews in the scriptures often means Judeans. And if you were to look very carefully, you would see that, and often the religious leaders and not the Jewish people themselves. So you really need to look at the New Testament in context.
Yes, this is important because I think that if we're going to talk about anti-Semitism, we're going to talk about all of the claims we've seen so far this morning. The real root of anti-Semitism is a hatred for the Jewish people, a desire to see them wiped out. When it comes to the New Testament, again, it was written by Jewish people. This is a Jewish book. Many of the concepts in the New Testament cannot be understood apart from their background in the Hebrew Bible. And so I want to take a close look at that. There are some verses from the New Testament that show that there is a Jewish background to it. The genealogy of Jesus in Matthew chapter 1, verse 1, that he is the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. We see the practice of the Jewishness in the New Testament. On the eighth day, they came to circumcise the child. A reference to one of the feast days, Hanukkah at Jerusalem, Jesus walking in the temple. And so we see that Paul talks about himself being a Jew. He was one of the Pharisees. He was thoroughly trained in the law of his fathers and zealous for God. And then we see James, a servant of God and the Lord Jesus Christ. The New Testament is a Jewish book, stands alongside the Hebrew Scriptures. And you really can't get away from the fact that it is historical, it is literature, it's full of Jewish things. Now, what we have is the claim, how can the book that was written by Jewish people be anti-Semitic? Well, it's not. But remember, in the early days of Christianity, there were no Gentile believers. And the whole conflict was about whether Jesus was the Messiah or not. And in the New Testament, in the Gospels, we see Jesus rebuking the Pharisees and scribes, not against their Jewishness, and not saying hateful things about wanting them killed. Jesus was talking about their hypocrisy. He was talking about things that were wrong, how they had twisted God's law and misinterpreted it. But you will not see Jesus condemning Israel. He talks about them being faithless in their covenants to God, but he did not say wipe the Jews off the face of the earth. And again, there's a quotation from the Old Testament in the prophet Isaiah saying, "Ah, sinful nation, a people loaded with guilt, a brood of evildoers, children given to corruption. They have forsaken the Lord. They have spurned the Holy One of Israel and turned their backs on him." So Jesus is following in the tradition of the Old Testament prophets by rebuking their people, his people, for their lack of faithfulness and for their hypocrisy. But it is not anti-Semitic to do so. The question that needs to be asked is not whether or not the New Testament is Jewish, but rather, is it true? That's the proper question. And when you look at the historicity and the validity of the New Testament, you cannot come away with any other conclusion but that it is a true record of God, but has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. So I hope that answers your question this morning. What I want to do in our remaining minutes is show how the Apostle Paul, the Hebrew of the Hebrews, the former persecutor of the church, became the greatest lover of the Jewish people. And you don't see anti-Semitism with Paul. You see absolutely love, a desire that he himself could be cut off so that his Jewish family, his brethren, would be saved. Listen to what Paul writes in Romans chapter 9. As he reflects in this chapter on God's sovereignty, and he speaks from the heart about his Jewish people, he says, "I am speaking the truth in Christ. I am not lying. My conscience bears me witness in the Holy Spirit that I have great sorrow and unceasing anguish in my heart. I myself were accursed and cut off for Christ for the sake of my brothers and kinsmen according to the flesh." And then Paul goes on to elaborate all about them. My point is that Paul stood in prayer and crying out to God that if it were possible, God, cut me off, curse me, and save your people. Paul obviously had a love for the Jewish people, not a hatred. He rebuked them for not understanding the scriptures as to pointing to Jesus as the Messiah. He debated with them in the marketplace. He warned them that God's judgment was coming on them unless they came to the knowledge of the truth. But he never hated them. He never wished them harm. He pleaded with God in this verse, God, just me off and save my people. Again, in Romans chapter 10, brothers, my heart's desire in prayer to God for them is that they may be saved. For I bear them witness that they have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge. For being ignorant of the righteousness of God and seeking to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes. Notice what Paul says. He laments their sin. They have a zeal, but not according to knowledge. He said, brothers, my heart's desire and prayer to God for them is that they may be saved. As I look through the pages of Scripture here, I can come to the easy conclusion that the Gospels in the New Testament is a testament of love, pleading, and great sorrow on the part of the apostles and the early Christians, pleading with Israel to be saved, pleading with them to turn their hearts to the Messiah, that Jesus is the promised Messiah. And they quote lots of passages from the Old Testament to make that claim. They strived in the marketplace, like Paul, to reason with the Jewish people according to the scriptures, that Jesus fulfilled many prophecies, born of a virgin, born in Bethlehem, crucified on a tree, his hands and feet nailed. And he quotes the Psalms and the prophets to point to the fact that you crucified Jesus, but God raised him up from the dead to display, put him on display, that he is indeed the Son of God with resurrection power, risen from the dead, that he is the promised Messiah. And so Paul was never anti-Semitic. Paul reasoned with the scriptures. He reasoned, he pled, he argued, he cried out to his Jewish friends. Yes, he was persecuted, and yes, he was stoned, left for dead, and yes, many, many unfortunate, horrible things happened to Paul. But he never stopped loving the Jewish people. He never stopped pleading to God for them. And when you read these scripture references that I shared with you, you see the heart of a man who is driven with love. And so my question to you this morning, in light of everything we've heard, with the anti-Semitism, with the UN, with the betrayal of the Obama administration against the Jewish people, and you see how the scriptures are calling that one day there's going to be a terrible, terrible war in the Middle East against the Jewish people. Let me ask you a very simple question. As a Christian, have a love for the Jewish people. Do you pray for them? And this is all important. At a time like now, as never before, is it more important that we stand for Israel? It is my great prayer that Donald Trump will be loyal to them, will show them kindness, will support them, will protect them. I believe he will. He has shown an awful lot of care and concern when this UN resolution was adopted and we decided to abstain for the vote. Donald Trump said this is wrong the way Israel's treated, and he said the way the United Nations treats them. He says everything is going to change on January 20th. I believe that. I believe that Barack Obama, there was a general hatred as far as I'm concerned, and just a real cavalier attitude towards the Jewish people. But I see a true and genuine love in Donald Trump for the Jewish nation. I know that Benjamin Netanyahu is very excited, can't wait for him to become president, because he sees in Donald Trump a true friend, a true ally. And so as we begin this new year, let's begin by standing with Israel and standing with the Jewish people. I always go back to this scripture because it is the truth, and it is something I want to leave us with this morning. It's in Genesis chapter 12. I'm sure you probably know it. Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 2. And I want you to hear what God says. Now the Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you," God says. "And him who dishonors you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed." Did you hear what God says? "I will bless those," Abraham, "bless you. And him who dishonors you, I will curse." It is very clear. God is calling us to be a blessing to Israel. He will bless us immensely. But if this government, if this administration turns their hardened heart away from God's people, it's very clear there are repercussions for that. And so we need to love the Jewish people, because they're our greatest ally and the greatest source of democracy in the Middle East. And so I'm calling on you to spend this year in standing and praying for the Jewish nation and the Jewish people. It is so important to do that. In light of everything you see happening in the world, you know the time is near. And so I urge you, stand with me and pray and stand with Israel. I really want to thank you, Mary, for being in the chat room today. It's been a long time since I've seen you. It's so good to see you again. And for everyone in the chat room, thank you so much for taking time out to come and listen to The Cross in the Desert today. I will see you on the Monday edition of The Cross in the Desert. Have yourself a fantastic weekend. Blessings into you. See you again on Monday.
Where the great of wrath are stored.